The 2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 362, The Goddess is Alive and Magic is Afoot, Mormon Pagan Women in the 21st Century, a paper presented by Doe Daughtry, with a response by John Dewey Remy.
And they make wonderful gifts. So I really encourage you to stop by the art auction if you have a chance. And now we're very pleased. Do you have a question? Oh, okay. I understand now that she's clearing out within the next hour. So if there is something you want, please go by.
Don't
and yeah, don't right, don't everybody leave, but but if you've been by and you and there's something you want to get, you might want to just run over and pick it up while you've got the chance. And now we're very pleased to hear from Doe.
Okay, sorry about that. Can you hear me? Okay, great. First of all, I just wanted to give you a little definition, a couple of definitions, just in case, and this isn't working for me, just in case you don't know. A neo-pagan, and these are quotes that I took off the internet, a neo-pagan, Wicca is a neo-pagan religion that was founded by Gerald Gardner in the 1960s. It is a neo-pagan reconstruction of witchcraft. Most Wiccans call themselves witches, but not all witches are necessarily Wiccan. In terms of the definition of a witch is a practitioner of witchcraft. Duh. There are many types and traditions of witches. A witch is not necessarily a Wiccan, though if a Wiccan practices witchcraft, they can be called a witch. So, in other words, Wicca is a religion. Witchcraft is something, a practice that somebody engages in, and a witch is the person who does that practice, engages in that practice. I just thought I'd bring that up right off, in case anybody wondered. I bought Michael Quinn's book, Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview, shortly after its release. I distinctly remember reading it at the time when I was just awakening to the issues that virtually consume me now as a scholar, a Mormon, and as a human being. Quinn's book was a part of my awakening, which largely took place in the Princeton Second Ward, the ward that served the university's rich and diverse student population. Up to that point, I had heard few details about Sunstone and the LDS intellectual community, other than that it was dangerous and a resource in a community to be avoided at all costs, so I avoided it. But Princeton opened my eyes and my world, and Michael Quinn was a part of that opening. While in the Princeton ward, I became close friends with a woman who had been born into an LDS Puerto Rican family and whose matriarch, her grandmother, read tarot and engaged in other indigenous forms of divination. Having survived a brutal marriage and divorcing her abusive husband, she was remarrying into our ward and beginning to revisit these areas of her life as both a reclaiming of her heritage and as a tool for her own personal empowerment. She told me stories of her life, including very interesting routine experiences with the spirit world, which reinforced my awareness of the diversity of Mormon spirituality, as well as added to what I considered might possibly be my own future options. However, it wasn't until I started working on my master's thesis, Bodies, Parts, and Passions, Erasing the Divine Feminine in the Mormon Tradition, that I reread Michael's book. My thesis argued that Heavenly Mother's erasure from Mormon consciousness, or perhaps it's better characterized as her reconstruction as an unavailable, invisible, and unknowable aspect of Mormonism, has had in part to do with her association, in part, I mean, it's complicated, with her association with what might be called New Age, and more specifically, women's feminist spirituality or goddess worship. Of course, this is a modern association, post-1960s. I went to Quinn's text to better understand what might have been early Mormon women's engagement with the magical elements of Mormonism's intersection with local folk culture. Toward the end of his text, Michael suggests that at the time of publication, LDS women in the Salt Lake Valley still read tea leaves, cards, and, as I recall him saying, even used crystals and seer stones for divination and healing, implying a continuity of divinatory practice that originated in early Mormonism. If this is not the case, then at least it was interesting for me to read. This revelation left me hungry to know just what these women had been doing. Given the increased Western cultural interest in and social recognition of women's spirituality, I speculated that if some LDS women in Utah were reading cards and using crystals, others were doing the same thing in other places, though perhaps not as a practice directly associated with early Mormonism, you know, like an ancestral practice. I felt that it would be important to try to discover as much as possible about these women for a variety of reasons beyond what they can tell us about these women themselves and early Mormonism or contemporary Mormonism. The main disciplinary goal of religious studies is to present information about what a religious tradition says about itself, as well as to reveal the inherent diversity of insider views. In addition, religious studies provides insights into an analysis of what others say about religious traditions and offers non-religious explanations for religious phenomena. This analysis, this type of analysis, inevitably raises questions about related issues such as social, cultural, and economic ones. Knowing something about LDS women who are what Janet Binion calls double dippers, Mormons who double dip into other cultural and religious pots to either supplement, complement, or replace mainstream Mormonism, can add to several larger studies in conversations in religious studies, such as those taking place about new religious movements. Conversion. What is conversion? What does that mean? How does it take place? Does it really take place? Religious change, virtual religion, religion on the internet, ritual studies, epistemologies, ways of knowing, and religious identities. My thoughts and questions about Mormons and New Age are concomitant with the interest of the Sunstone community, much to my delight, given that each symposium for the last several years has included papers and panel discussions on these topics. For instance, a 2002 Sunstone panel discussion put together by Lisa Hansen, which she titled Current Research and the Quest for Personal Meaning, enabled panelists and participants to explore the ways in which they, quote, relate their experiences with New Age ideas to their gospel roots, end quote. These New Age experiences included the concept of past lives or the experience of past lives, divination, synchronicity, and human potential in relation to higher human capacities such as ESP and others. Even topics that might seem to some as being more theologically orthodox fall under the rubric of reconciling Mormon beliefs about magic and what constitutes a magical worldview. For instance, the question of what happens when Mormons do stuff, the ways in which the LDS Church and its members conceptualize the efficacy of ordinances, was explored in a 2001 paper titled Defending Magic, Explaining the Necessity of Ordinances. This paper outlined theories of efficacy and addressed the Western notion that ordinances are symbolic. Was anybody here present in the Pentacle? You know, the... Okay. So the question of whether, you know, do symbols have real power? Well, the notion of a symbol is a Western idea. You know, we're the only ones who say, oh, that's symbolic. Everybody else on the planet says, no, that's powerful. That does something. And so when we say the word symbol, we're automatically not getting it. Okay? I just had to throw that out. So this paper talked about symbolism. In other words, the question in this context is this: how do rituals work? Through symbolic means, or do they really do something? Put still another way, what forces are at work when we restart a sacrament prayer or repeat a baptism? Are ordinances, prayers, etc., a way of actually having an effect in the world and the world beyond? And if so, how does that work? If not, what does that mean? What does it mean to work actually symbolically? If it's not a direct metaphysical efficacy. It is difficult to know which is more distressing to the institutional LDS Church and to Latter-day Saints at large, the implication that a magical Mormon worldview might mean that Mormonism is a cult, an archaic or unmodern, or that such a worldview implies or perhaps even conveys a non-Christian pagan identity. Arguing for the continued existence of a magical Mormon worldview, both Michael Quinn and Dan Vogel raise the concern that 20th century Mormons have been disenchanted, right along with the rest of Western culture, so that many of us dispute the evidence for that magical worldview in the contemporary setting. In part, this disagreement arises because the Church is trying to break its association with occult practices, what people consider to be occult practices, by advertising Mormonism as a religious combination of naturalism and pragmatism, as something that works socially and is congruent with science, but isn't mystical or new age, and is also decidedly Christian rather than pagan. This rationalist shift is obvious at the local level. Studies show that LDS beliefs about the efficacy of garments have actually changed, whereas I would argue that most Mormons of my generation categorically believed in the mystical power of garments to protect based on personal worthiness, Today's younger Mormons seem to see garments as symbolic rather than efficacious in any real concrete sense. Thus, when confronting our magical worldview, we fall into the trap of projecting our own modern interpretations of ordinances, materials, and events onto Joseph Smith's time and context, and we're embarrassed by the notion that Joseph could really have looked into a hat to see the Book of Mormon. We want translation to be just that, whatever we think that means today, without hats, without seer stones, or other magic. Another aspect of the interpretation problem has to do with external attacks made by critics of the church. LDS apologists have found that one way of dealing with and responding to associations critics make between the magical Mormon worldview and Satanism or occult practices is to situate LDS belief and practice in historical context. One example of this response is the Fair paper titled Inverted Stars on LDS Temples from 2002, which details various historical interpretations of five-pointed stars and contextualizes their cultural use in early Christianity, early America, and early Mormonism, and reminds readers of the Pentacle's previously, quote, undemonic meaning and its 19th century identification with evil by a defrocked French Catholic deacon. Other such articles argue that because this symbol wasn't associated with Satan or evil in the time of the temple's construction, critics of the church are mistaken by projecting that association back in time onto its early LDS use. Thus, Mormon apologists can argue against interpreting pentacles on the Salt Lake and Nauvoo temples as relating to magic or as a satanic or otherwise evil symbol, while at the same time arguing for the historic and sacred nature of the symbol. In other words, the question is not that magic doesn't exist, but that it operates through approved channels, which we don't call magicians, but prophets and apostles, and anyone else who has priesthood authority. In 2001, Publishers Weekly reported the rise in divination sales and noted two interesting and seemingly unrelated reports. New Age materials in all areas have increasingly expressed, quote, goddess, Wiccan, and other predominantly female themes, end quote, and that science fiction authors are more likely to be LDS than any other religion. The article quoted someone as saying that, quote, Mormons have an outlook on God and the universe similar to science fiction writers that other Christian churches do not, end quote. This outlook, I would argue, involves that magical worldview, and is why the group of LDS women I interviewed have sought out New Age and women's spirituality resources to supplement or replace what they find missing in Mormonism. It is also why they find their hybrid spirituality at least somewhat congruent with traditional Mormonism, if not institutional Mormonism of the 21st century. It is important to try to understand the LDS Church's position on this issue of what I call Mormon-pagan or Mormo-pagan identity or identities. The question of what constitutes Mormon identity is, of course, complex. In truth, it's hard to know where such an identity begins to take shape. Becoming LDS is a process of conversion, of course, but what does it mean to convert to something? It is clear from looking at some Latin American communities that their conversion to Catholicism was less conversion than it was syncretistic combination of traditions. LDS conversion is less pliable because of the centralization and standardization of virtually all aspects of Mormonism. Tradition in the LDS Church associates conversion with the experience of coming to know that Joseph Smith had a vision, restored the true Church of Jesus Christ, and translated the Book of Mormon, which is an historical document. This experience gets articulated as a testimony that the Church is true. Explanations for why human beings in any given time or place are religious, engage in religious behaviors, or choose to affiliate with a particular tradition generally come from, of course, theological or secular sources. The Church's theological explanations for conversion focus on the witness of the Holy Ghost to the truthfulness of the knowledge, with no particular hierarchy in terms of which aspect of testimony should develop first. Some individuals join the LDS Church because of their engagement with the Book of Mormon. Still others convert because they come to accept as true Joseph Smith as the restorer of the lineage of prophets and priesthood authority, LDS teachings about human potential, or the concept of forever families. Others come to a more subtle, dawning realization that they know the Church is true because it is congruent with their previously held view of the world. After gaining a testimony, the next step of conversion is for individuals to actually join the Church, becoming a part of the covenant relationship with God. A large part of acquiring religious identity has to do with situating oneself in relation to others. Institutional sources are provided to address such questions of identity. And what we're talking about here, of course, is a new, you know, how does the Church discuss New Age? That New Age identity. Little has actually been provided, and what has been provided to the general church member comes not from high-level authorities, but is presented in essay or question-and-answer format in church magazines. One example is an excerpt from a 1996 Ensign I Have a Question column. The question is, I am bothered by certain activities associated with Halloween. How can parents make Halloween a fun time while avoiding practices and behaviors that may grieve the spirit? The answer from, of all things, a visiting teacher in Willard, Utah, quotes Boyd K. Packer's and James E. Faust's warnings against, quote, the dark side of spiritual things, end quote, and, quote, the mischief of devil worship, sorcery, casting spells, witchcraft, voodooism, black magic, and all other forms of demonism, end quote. A 1979 essay in the New Era by Terry J. Moyer is titled Questions Astrologers Avoid Like Cancer. Moyer argues that astrology is, quote, an ancient form of magic and Satan's counterfeit for real prophecy, end quote. In 1991, R. Kim Davis, bishop and associate professor of surgery at the University of Utah, noted in the Ensign that, quote, some aspects of the New Age movement may seem harmless, but when we compare basic principles of the gospel with New Age philosophies, we see that New Age beliefs can lead us away from our Heavenly Father, allowing us to rationalize behavior and become ensnared in sin, end quote. The church curriculum brings forward earlier prophetic warnings. In the teachings of presidents of the church, Joseph F. Smith, in the chapter 13, Stand by the Truth, Lest You Be Deceived, church members are warned to beware of false teachings and false spirits, noting specifically that, quote, when visions, dreams, tongues, or prophecy, impressions, or any extraordinary gift or inspiration convey something out of harmony with the accepted revelations of the church or contrary to the decisions of its constituted authorities, Latter-day Saints may know that it is not of God, no matter how plausible it may appear. Anything at discord with that which comes from God through the head of the church is not to be received as authoritative or reliable, end quote. President Smith mentions imitation miracles and goes on to equate witchcraft with evil, reassuring members that there is no power in it, only as it is believed in and accepted. Thus, President Smith confirms other Ensign and New Era sources. Witchcraft is an element of indigenous religious traditions all over the globe, belief in which missionaries and local authorities have to confront continually. Most often, church leaders use scripture to make the distinction between true and counterfeit beliefs and practices. For example, Richard G. Ellsworth characterizes what he calls Saul's descent to evil in the context of the king having sought revelation through a witch. Quote, he had become a liar, an equivocator, a cheat, a thief, and a murderer. Now, confused in mind and darkened in spirit, he sought help from satanic sources, end quote. In similar fashion, David H. Yarn, Jr. reminds Ensign readers of Moses' deliverance of Israel and his warning to them against, quote, divination, enchanters, witches, consulters of familiar spirits, wizards, necromancers, and other abominations, end quote. Contrasting such evil influences with the prophet, which the Lord would surely raise up. Given these institutional attitudes about witchcraft and, quote, New Age, why would an LDS woman confess to being a witch or a pagan, and how could anyone see neo-paganism as being in any way congruent with Mormonism? Moreover, to what degree is it possible to blend Mormon identities with self-identification as a pagan or a witch? These questions about identity and identities are the overarching concern of this study. I asked 13 women a series of questions relating to their experience of and feelings about Mormonism and paganism, and I received 5 responses, which is not bad. And the way I found these women was I actually had a student in my ritual, symbol, and myth class. And all of my classes, I have them, except for the very, very large classes, I have them give me their first assignment is to write a personal statement. They have to give me a picture. I tell them I can't remember my grandson's name. So if you want me to know who you are, you better give me a picture and tell me something about yourself. And they have to tell me at least one thing about themselves that they want me to know. And I had a student last semester, what she wanted me to know was that she had been raised Mormon and was now Wiccan. And so I was already interested in this. I'd already had some other experiences. But I started doing searches on beliefnet.com, where I had done some earlier research, and started looking for people on chat, you know, on message boards that identified themselves in this way. And I just had an email the other day from someone else who wants to respond to my question. So it's all over the country, all different ages. They are a small sample of different ages, different sexual orientations, and located all across the nation. I was interested in knowing what aspects of paganism they were interested in or studying, how they were exposed to it, and what they found most appealing about it. In addition, I wanted to know what their spiritual practice looks like, if it contains any elements of Mormonism, and what elements of paganism it contains. In other words, I was interested in hearing about what, if anything, they find in paganism that is congruent with their understanding of Mormonism. Almost as an afterthought, and though I wasn't sure that it was relevant, it seemed important to know if they had been born and raised LDS or if they were converts. Of the 5 women I interviewed, 3 were converts. Interestingly enough, further investigation reveals a distinction between converts and those who were born and raised LDS. the two generational Mormons were the only ones who had severed all ties to the LDS Church by actually having their names removed from church records. One woman who took this action reported that the decision to have her name removed was the first true adult decision she'd ever made regarding her own identity, all other previous decisions having been influenced by LDS culture. On the other hand, the LDS converts I interviewed were working to integrate and/or reconcile their Mormon and pagan identities, perhaps because as converts they had already made a major conversion decision and therefore experienced their religious identities as being more fluid and more accommodating. Beyond this initial division, the women located themselves on the spectrum of Mormon-pagan identity. Quintessentially Mormon, more Mormon than pagan, hybrid Mormon-pagan, more pagan than Mormon, quintessentially pagan. It is easy to hypothesize that these women would have been motivated to explore paganism because of a conscious desire to incorporate less hierarchical ideas into their religious lives. However, if the issue was only a rejection of institutional authority, they could perhaps have simply left the church for an evangelical community, which by definition is non-hierarchical, and also makes available a wider range of roles for women in religious roles. Indeed, Brooks' family left the LDS Church to become evangelical Christians. Thus, both parents and child rejected LDS Church culture, though in radically different ways. What are the dominant pieces, the key attributes of Mormon identity, and which of these are maintained, broken, and/or reconstructed in these women's religious lives? Is there something quintessentially Mormon that follows people through the changes they make in response to their own needs? The two elements of identity that surface repeatedly as I talk to these women are that of testimony and community. The communal and social aspects of Mormonism are the environment in which one's personal testimony gets articulated and refined, and in which Mormon identity is negotiated through communal agreements. The testimony that is most relevant to me right here in this little explication is the agreement, the communal agreement or testimony that has to do with Heavenly Mother. The LDS community agrees that she exists, but also tacitly agrees that attempts to draw attention to that knowledge or to worship her in any way is a breach of a boundary, the distinction between that true and false religion that the general authorities have spoken of. Based on reports that interest in and a hunger for devotion to the goddess is what drives the New Age market and the increase in conversion to Wicca and other earth-based and mystery religions, I suspected that these women would report having a testimony of the existence of Heavenly Mother as a driving force in their hybrid spirituality. This did turn out to be the case, as every respondent noted the desire to know and develop a relationship with Mother in Heaven, as well as frustration at the church's position on her role in their lives. Their personal identities seemed to be linked to hers, even for those who no longer subscribe to the LDS notion of heaven or think of her as a perfected anthropomorphic being, still consider the goddess to have something to do with them, as if knowing her in whatever form has something to do with knowing themselves. Every respondent considered Heavenly Mother to be the aspect of pagan belief and practice most congruent with Mormonism. Brooke notes that, quote, although I do not personify the divine feminine, when I use a name for the divine feminine, such as Asherah, I picture a symbol of that aspect which I am trying to connect to, not a specific face or form. I do see that this is where my ideas about her started, albeit in a very structured form. She's talking about Heavenly Mother. Trish states that she too believes that, quote, that Heavenly Mother, Goddess, is beautiful and a very big part of life. I also believe that when the church states that there is more truth that hasn't come to light, but we're not ready for it yet, it's about goddess. It's about pagan practices. It's about worshiping them as parents. My kids will have both God and goddess in their lives. My older kids are aware of goddess, and my oldest daughter is leaning towards Wicca, end quote. Charlene says that she has, quote, always seen Heavenly Mother as completely beautiful and powerful, like a wonderful, wise, and gorgeous queen. In the temple, when we think of what we may become, I envision being powerful, beautiful, and wise, just like her, filled with light and love, brilliant beyond words. I do wish we would focus on her more in church, end quote. Trish also argues, quote, I think there are many other LDS women who believe, wish they could pray to Goddess, but don't have the guts or knowledge that would allow them to do so, end quote. This insight came to her after Mother's Day last year when she gave the Relief Society closing prayer and, quote, wished our Heavenly Mother, Goddess, a happy birthday, or Mother's Day. She said, I heard a few gasps, but after the prayer I had several women thank me for it. I've never seen anyone thank others for a closing prayer before, end quote. Trish is also concerned about her children not having to wait until their 40s to, quote, realize the real fullness of the truth, end quote. Charlene reports that recently her Relief Society had a lengthy conversation about Heavenly Mother. Quote, we all spoke of why she isn't discussed much. We came up with a feeling that Father wants to protect her from mockery, like when people take the name of God in vain or curse and swear, end quote. And this is real typical. She told another sister about, quote, seeking the goddess, and she is on the same path, end quote. Both women agree that their paths are right, presumably meaning true, as opposed to false religion. And both feel that they need to, quote, bring this out more into the church with respect to her sacredness, end quote. Charlene, like most of the other women, wear pentacles as a symbol of their commitment to their path and their relationship with the goddess, with Heavenly Mother. Quote, I have a charm bracelet I wear. It has a pentagram with the tree of life intertwined. It has the goddess, and it has a bumblebee. I wear it to church without worry because I know in my heart that those who would pass judgment are just ignorant of what can be, what other pieces of truth are waiting for us all to find, end quote. Jane, who is openly affiliated with a Wiccan coven, also identifies the presence of a goddess as being the most congruent thread running through both traditions. Because she is gay, she is also grateful for the pagan community's embrace of her homosexuality, the issue for which she removed her name from church records. She envisions deity as a father and a mother together and has most recently decided to return to church in an effort to more hybridize her identity. She considers herself a very spiritual person and believes that, quote, the pagan, Wiccan, Mormon path is the right place for me at this time, end quote. She wants to be a hybrid Mormon-pagan, but right now identifies herself as being more pagan than Mormon. She sees Wicca as being the aspect of her life that is least compatible with her Mormon desires. At this point, I haven't established whether or not this has to do with the fact that Wicca is an actual affiliation. I mean, she actually is affiliated with this group, a joining of something, or if she thinks that witchcraft, the practice, is the part that's incongruent. Charlene doesn't have that problem. She reports having a temple recommend and being active in the LDS church, and so is the respondent whose identity is the most hybrid. In fact, her argument is that paganism is absolutely congruent with Mormonism, and this is based on the notion that Mormonism contains the whole. It is the container for all truth. Or perhaps it would be more accurate to say that Mormonism and paganism are two shadows cast by the same truth, truth with a capital T. With regard to human identity, she states, quote, I believe we can all be little mini-prophets of our own, and that if we would just believe in ourselves and in the possibility of miracles, we can all be so inspired and magical. We have that divine heritage. We should be magical, end quote. Interesting. Similarly, Trish feels that the presence of pentacles on LDS temples and other institutional but public buildings confirms her belief that Mormonism is true, while validating her chosen hybrid Mormon-pagan path. Brooke is at the other end of the spectrum. She situates herself, quote, somewhere between more pagan than Mormon and quintessentially pagan. I am a pagan. I don't really identify myself as Mormon per se, but my experiences as a Mormon led me to this moment, so I have to at least acknowledge that part of my life, end quote. Most notably, she confirmed another of my major suspicions when I started doing this. She acknowledged being, quote, a curious outsider who was once an insider. Despite the fact that she hasn't stayed connected to the church even marginally and has no idea what progress the church has made in any one area, she recognizes that her paganism is nevertheless informed by her Mormon identity. Quote, I still feel that there is a whole part of my life that only other Mormons and ex-Mormons will ever understand. I lived 20 years as a part of that community. I cannot completely erase those experiences. And so she feels grateful that I put her in contact with these other women and that she no longer feels alone. And she has somebody off whom she can bounce her previous Mormon identity. Sarah, who is an active, thinks of herself as more Mormon, more pagan than Mormon. Her main concern was with what she perceived to be the failure of both the LDS church and its local community to truly see and address her and her family's social, physical, and spiritual needs. She and her husband have both become involved in what is called heathenism, a cultural tradition informed by Nordic myths and reconstructed practices. Though Joanna Pearson, a scholar who writes about, a textbook for religious studies classrooms on New Age and Wicca and Native American spirituality. She notes that some scholars and most heathens argue that heathenism is something other than pagan. Sarah identifies herself as pagan. Heathenism's emphasis on family and nature, ancestral links, and conservative values are what attracts her to the community. The community, she argues, has been much more responsive than the LDS community. The outcome of her interactions with other heathens is the perception that their relationships are more truly reciprocal, generated by what she perceives to be genuine concern. On the other hand, her experience of Mormon community has been based on the anxiety and guilt produced by fulfilling communal responsibilities, the completion of which generate the Mormon version of religious merit that ultimately leads to exaltation, as opposed to genuine reciprocity and compassion. At the same time, Sarah has other problems with Mormonism that seem insurmountable, particularly with regard to history. An emphasis on history is another common thread in both Mormon and pagan identity, particularly for goddess spirituality. However, both populations have vastly different ways of approaching the issue. According to Pearson, part of the witch identity is based on what witches call the burning times, referring to the millions of women who died in the religiously motivated witch hunts. Millions is in quote. Nobody really knows how many. This identity construction involves the conscious repackaging of history in which, quote, memories of the past are thus focused on as a central source of meaning, with the burning times used as a rallying symbol and the witch regarded as both as martyr and as a representation of repressed female power, end quote. This is not unlike Mormon history, which functions as LDS theology. In other words, both witches and Mormons identify with an historic chain of memory based on persecution. Unlike Mormons, however, witches admit to the problems inherent in such an interpretation of history, noting that the truth of the numbers dead is unimportant, as is the actual existence of an ancient goddess-worshipping matriarchy. They don't care. Rather, what matters to them is the recognition of a shared identity and the function of the myth in their lives. In other words, to a witch, being true and being factual do not have to be coterminous. It is no surprise, then, that the LDS Church's insistence on the historicity of the Book of Mormon and on standardized and simplified Mormon history as literal truth is one element that almost all of these women find distasteful about Mormonism. Another common thread between all five respondents is their emphasis on the validity of their own experience as the ultimate authority and the rejection of institutional authority as a mediator or judge of their spiritual experiences and choices. Even Charlene, who regularly attends the temple, insists that being Mormon is not what is most important about one's spiritual path, but rather being true to one's intuition, quote, the whisperings of one's heart, end quote. She says, quote, you can be a witch and LDS or not LDS. Which suggests that being Mormon is less relevant to her than being aware of one's divine potential, which for her ultimately is magical. In terms of spiritual practice, each of these women engages in the same core practices, the wearing of pentacles, altar construction and maintenance, meditation, and prayer to the god and goddess. They haven't dumped the god, or God, Heavenly Father. He's still there. And the practice of some form of divination. Beyond that, Charlene attends the temple. For 10 years, Brooke has belonged to a Unitarian Universalist congregation and participated in their pagan circle and has recently joined a coven. Trish is learning to do spell work and does rituals at her altar, and Sarah has begun attending heathen hearths with her family. Jane has been attending church again, even though she has had her name removed from church records. She reports celebrating the Sabbaths, which are pagan holidays, and full moons with her coven, and she also has a smaller circle that celebrates the Sabbaths, full moons, and dark moons when they can. In addition, all the women reflect a common motif of pagan Wiccan conversion and identity, intellectualism. Though studies show that the intellectual conversion motif is uncommon in other religious traditions, it is strong in Wicca. One has to be open to religious alternatives and to put time and effort into searching for a community to join. These women conform to studies that suggest that Wiccans don't just go straight from Christianity to paganism. They have to search and think and work it out. According to Pearson, quote, modern paganism depends to a great extent on the literate world, end quote, so that fluency is obtained almost entirely through books, internet, and other media. Indeed, all of these women indicate that they consider reading and study of such things as Wicca, herbalism, or Celtic myth to be an essential part of their spiritual practice. Like becoming Mormon, becoming pagan is an ongoing reconstruction of identity. Both pagan and Mormon identities are complex, contradictory, and confusing. For instance, images specific to the witch, in particular, include the belief that witches can be strong, independent, powerful, guardian of nature. They can also be old, ugly, and, you know, all those negative things, fraternized with Satan and demons. She can be a guardian of nature, practitioner of magic and spell work. She recognizes light and dark. She worships old pagan deities. She's a priestess of the goddess, an herbalist. She could comes to recognize herself as a witch or a pagan. She becomes a witch through the intellectual, mystical, and recognizing. That's also similar to the motif that shows up in Mormonism of suddenly, I've heard so many people say, I just recognized, I saw in Mormonism things that I had believed all along but never found anywhere else. This is also the case with Wicca, or, you know, witchcraft, which is identified with a past persecution chain of memory, and they defy patriarchal authority, or they seek after their own, and they are overwhelmingly university educated. In the United States, two to one, they are women 2-to-1. In terms of Mormon identity, Mormons recognize multiple gods and goddesses, but they only worship one god. They identify with a past persecution chain of memory. They are strongly tied to patriarchal authority, but they do recognize individual authority to some extent. In the U.S., they are most likely to be university educated. Pagan and Mormon identities have been outside the mainstream, and both groups have been simultaneously engaged in a process of identity rehabilitation. It wasn't so long ago that identifying oneself as a Mormon could generate suspicion and contempt. The same, of course, is true for pagans. Both traditions still raise eyebrows, though both are transcending stereotypes about their goals and their motives and places in society. In the context of our emphasis this week on the divine feminine, this paper is only a tease. I still know really very little about these women and others like them. I'm making contacts all over the country with independent bookshops, New Age and other types of bookshops, and women's groups who suggest that this Mormon-pagan hybrid identity is not as rare as one might think. As I said earlier, Heavenly Mother was the thread that bound these women to their experience of Mormonism and informed their religious and spiritual practices, regardless of their relationship to the LDS Church. In addition, I found, to my surprise, as I said, that another thread between them was the failure of the LDS community, the thing that the Church does best, for which it is best known and in which it takes the most pride. Their fellow Latter-day Saints were incapable, not necessarily because they didn't want to, but because they didn't know how to respond to whatever distinguished these women and their families from other ward members, whether it was financial problems, sexual identity, questions of church history, or a desire to know Heavenly Mother. I hope that if any of you knows a woman like this, or are a woman like this, you will first make it known that you will first know that you are not alone, and make it known to who you know, the person you know, that they are not alone, and then you will contact me. Thank you.
Well, though, this is a session that I probably would not have come to if I hadn't been chairing it, because it's not a topic that I thought I was particularly interested in, but I really enjoyed your paper. And one of the things that it reminded me was that my grandmother, who was just as devout a Mormon as you would find anywhere and who knew her pioneer grandparents, visited the Peepstone Lady of Cache Valley.
Yes.
There was a dialogue article about the Peepstone Lady a number of years ago. I don't know if you've seen it. It was written by Waylon Hand, who was at, I think, UCLA. And you might want to look that up. Anyway, thank you for that paper. Our respondent is John Dewey Remy. He graduated with a bachelor's degree from UC Irvine. He's currently studying comparative religions at UC Irvine and supporting his wife, Jana, through her PhD program. Is she also at UC Irvine? Yeah. Okay. Back there. Hi. He's also an award-winning author of several short stories, including Ochi-chan's Funeral, which was published in Sunstone. John.
I asked him to come be my reporter. He was my choice.
And I'm still wondering why. Why me? Actually, that was the first thing I did ask. I asked, though, why me? You know, it just seems like there are other either feminist scholars or people are just much better qualified than me to be standing here talking to you. But I can't refuse, though. And My response, I had a choice between doing more of an academic response or more of a personal response. And actually, this is probably less of a response and more of something that's branched off from what those talked about today. And so I apologize for not, and I'm not supposed to start with an apology, but I apologize for not dealing directly with all of the topics in her paper. I asked her permission, and she said it was okay. So... When I asked why she wanted me to respond. She referred to an email that I had sent to her and to several of other of my Mormon feminist friends. Thanks, Jenna. I think back in April, and I'm going to go ahead and share part of this email, if that's all right. In the email I say, quote, "I'm on a quest for the divine feminine, and I am seeking help from the Mormon feminists I know and respect. I have very little concept of a female deity. All my life, whenever I've prayed, I have addressed Father in heaven. Any intimate experience I have had with deity has been with him and not with Christ, who many feel embodies much of Christianity's feminine attributes. I am beginning to feel like I've been robbed. I have some serious issues with male authority figures and feel that I could better connect with a divine mother. I would like to experiment with seeking out the divine feminine, exploring this issue. As a Mormon, Heavenly Mother is one place to begin. Other possible sources, Gnostic Christianity. I'm just thinking out loud in this email. I also have some affection for and attraction to Kuan Yin, the popular Chinese mother goddess, and an incarnation of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. I'm currently studying Christian feminist theology, but it tends to be very critical and reactive to existing patriarchal religious structures. I would like to take a more positive and constructive approach. I know that this is a very unorthodox approach, creating or discovering gods to meet my own needs, rather than assuming that I have to take what gods I've been dealt. If you feel uncomfortable responding to me, I understand completely. If you don't mind responding, I would like to know where you all turn to fill this void in your lives. Perhaps you have never felt such a void, and if so, why not?" So this doesn't respond directly to the relationship between paganism and Mormonism that those talked about, but it does respond to one of the needs that is not... Doe mentioned that these women turn to other sources to fill needs that they feel are not being met within Mormonism. And so in that sense, I feel like I feel some affinity with that. Maybe not perfect empathy with the same issues, but definitely some sympathy, and I have some of these similar issues. I feel that this... I'm done with the email now. I feel that this quest is especially difficult for Mormon women, this quest for the divine feminine, for goddess. You know that Heavenly Mother exists, but you are given nothing more to go on, and it has come to the point that the mere mention of Mother in Heaven in prayer draws gasps from a Relief Society audience. It is as though you are starving and given a brief glimpse of a great feast before the door was slammed on your face. In your face. The aroma lingers in the air, but access to the meal is forbidden you. I have sought for Divine Mother images from a variety of unorthodox sources as I have tried to fill the mother void in my own heart and spirit. I have some affinity for the Chinese Buddhist goddess of compassion, Guan Yin, who started out as a male deity, but who gradually transformed into a more of a mother figure. But I still have much to learn about her. When I was going through an especially hard time earlier this year, I turned to tarot card images, to try to gain knowledge of goddess archetypes and my own troubled relationship with patriarchy. And so this is where some of my own personal experience overlaps with pagan and with New Age experience. If I can just share a little bit about that, one experience that I had is I went through a deck of tarot cards, and I used it just for... I wanted to know what my response to the different images were. And I decided to pull my favorite cards and the cards that I had the most negative response to. And I found myself... there's a card called the Hierophant, or the Pope. and it shows a, you know, like a church authority figure of, in kind of a Roman Catholic style, seated on a card called the Emperor. Again, a man on a stone throne. Oh, he's keeping the thumbs down. And that card went in the negative response. And I responded very positively to the cards like, my favorite is the High Priestess, who, and I'm not sure I could give a full description of her, but she's sits in front of a veil in a temple-like setting, and she has both authority and knowledge and wisdom. And I also responded well to the Empress, who is like a fruitful mother figure, and she sits on a much more comfortable throne than the stone one that the Emperor sits on. But she's full figured. She's pregnant. She sits in a field full of ripened wheat. And these are the ones that I was feeling more affinity to, and I was wondering, you know, I had to turn to these images to fill some of these needs, because I didn't feel like I was finding them within Mormonism. I wanna do, just in closing, one short experiment, and hopefully leave some time for questions for Doe. One of the things that impressed me the most was there was one of the women who was interviewed had this clear image of Heavenly Mother. Let's see if I can... Do you remember that, Doe?
I mean, this is an expert, too.
Let me see if I can find it really quick. We'll see who gets to it first. I closed your paper, and so...
Ah, okay.
Okay. Charlene says that she has always seen Heavenly Mother as a completely beautiful and powerful, like a wonderful, wise, and gorgeous queen in the temple, when we think of what... Oh, like a wonderful, wise, and gorgeous queen. Thank you. And she wants to be powerful, beautiful, and wise, just like her. And so I tried a little experiment today. I've tried again and again to picture Mother in Heaven, and finally reading, hearing this, Charlene's comment, I felt like maybe I could come up with something. And so I write fiction. I put together this little word image, and I'm going to close with that. And please bear with me. This is, I'm a man trying to write about women, and so I'm disadvantaged from the get-go here. I picture a young mother in a student apartment. Her husband is always away, studying for medical school and working nights as a security guard. All day long, she carries the newborn girl while chasing her two-year-old boy around. She is away from extended family, spends Sundays in the nursery, and has very little social life. She hasn't felt the spirit for a long time. What she feels is tired, numb, alone. She doesn't know it, but she is also struggling with postpartum depression. One night she nearly snaps. Her husband has been gone since breakfast and won't be back for hours. Her girl is colicky and her boy spent 2 hours throwing a tantrum. She is afraid that her neighbors think she's abusing her children and are going to call the police on her. She kneels by the bed and begins to pray in desperation and falls asleep. She looks up and realizes that there is a light next to her, hovering near the nightstand. It grows brighter and brighter, filling the whole room. There's a curvy silhouette in the middle of the light, a woman. The light leaves the corners and coalesces about this glorified being. Her hair and robe are so white that they appear to be glowing softly. The heavenly woman eases her strong hips onto the edge of the bed. She cradles the young mother's chin in her fingertips and says, "You are my beloved daughter. I will hear you." The young mother says nothing but embraces her mother, burying her face in her breasts and crying until there's nothing left to give. Mother strokes her daughter's hair. and tells her how she had carried her and the toddler and the newborn in her belly and nursed them and taught them before sending them into this harsh world. She tells the young woman that she's experienced all this before, the dread and excitement when she missed her period, weeks of nausea and not keeping anything down, the ugly, bloated feeling of pregnancy, the tired, disinterested husband, the pains of childbirth, and so much more. She understands. The young woman looks up into the royal, careworn face of her mother and sees a tired smile, the wrinkles just beginning. She knows now that she has someone she can turn to, that the days will be difficult, but that she sees that, like her mother, she too has been anointed by sanctified women to someday rule as a queen and priestess. She falls asleep there, at peace, for a couple of hours. This was a real cathartic experience for me to write this, and some of you I know could do a much better job of this, and I'm just going to leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you, John. That was a wonderful word image. I don't know if others could do it better, but I know I couldn't have. Not my kind of thing. But I've been sitting here thinking of some questions, but I think that I would prefer to have questions from the audience. So if you have questions, if it's a brief question, I will repeat it in the microphone. If you have something a little longer to say, please come up and say it, so it'll be on the tape. Scott, he's coming forward. Okay.
I lived in Detroit for 30 years, and in 1968, my wife and I visited in the apartment home of Teddy Porter, and bless me, Teddy, if this gets recorded, that I am quoting you close enough. The question is a little uncertain, but the answer is very vivid to me. And Teddy told my wife and I that she had been praying, and in her prayer to Mother in Heaven, she said, "Why don't we hear more?" And she heard the answer, "Why, no one has ever asked."
Thank you, Scott. Did you have a question?
In the extended stay motel I was living in before I closed my house a few weeks ago, I passed a car with a bumper sticker that said, "Sorry I missed church, but I've been busy studying witchcraft and learning to become a lesbian." That's kind of a humorous way to start, which is kind of a typical way Mormons start speeches. But what was reflected in that is a longing to identify with the feminine aspects of theology that are often, you know, suppressed in the Christian and theistic biblical mainstream. As I was talking to Doe yesterday, I dated a girl that was Wiccan for quite a while. Was in love with her. Pagans make you feel alive. Mormon girls are brutal on the ego. They're uptight. You can't really talk about sex with them. A lot of them are just bored. Most of them are Republicans where I come from anyway. So I dated all 10 Mormon girls were compatible with me, and I realized that maybe I'm going to marry a pagan, so how can I get along? At the time, I was training for maybe a career in CES, and I talked to some of the superiors and my bishop, and they're kind of going, "I don't see how it's going to work. You can't bring all your church friends and have her doing hermetic spells and that sort of stuff." I think it'll work pretty well. I can see. But when I talk with Melanie, and that's her name, often we would talk about Mormon metaphysics. And when you make this pagan-Mormon distinction, what I would say about whether it's the idea of animals having spirits or obviously embodied God. Witches believe that. Mainline Christians don't believe that. The idea of embodied God is completely pagan as far as mainline Christian world's concerned. So the ontotheological tradition of Christianity anyway, and the biblical world. And so I was, shocked. There's a lot of commonality here. And later on, I moved from where I was dating her. She married someone else, and that's another long story. But I dated another witch who had converted to Mormonism. And she did leave, mostly because of inadequacies in the community. But why part of her conversion story was reading the Pearl of Great Price and some things, going, witches believe this. And I said, okay, well, yeah, I know that, because I've dated a witch before. But what's the upshot? What do you see as the possible things you'd like to happen as far as the institutional church, and maybe I should just say the community in general at certain grassroots level, incorporating goddess ideas, Heavenly Mother ideas? How could that be expressed in the liturgy without completely throwing people into a complete tailspin? I mean, do you have a vision? No, there's not really much point in one, is there? But, I mean, what would you like to see then, speculatively? Because I think that'd be an interesting thing to hear what you have a view on.
I don't know that I've really thought that far. I would actually, my plan is to go and visit Charlene, who has the one who has the temple recommend, and really she believes that Mormonism and paganism are congruent. She said she believed that Adam and Eve were taught, paganism was what they were taught in the Garden of Eden. And then it just kind of got diluted, all of these. And then Joseph Smith was the one who restored all of these ideas. I would like to go visit her and see how she, and go to church with her and see how she behaves in the ward and see how people treat her. And then I might be able to get an idea of what, you know, of maybe envisioning, you know, what some sort of, you know, intersection might look like. I mean, I think I haven't done exhaustive research. I mean, this is where I'm going with my PhD work, in part. And so, I mean, I'm just starting on this. This is just a tease for me, too, especially in terms of any conclusions or anything. But I suspect that there's more that the Church has said about New Age, witches and things like that, but I haven't found it yet. But my suspicion is that there probably isn't all that much, and the reason is that there are so many congruences that it only calls attention. I mean, for those of you who sat through the presentation this morning about pentacles on the temples, he indicated that he had called the church to find out. To get an explanation for them, and he said, "Oh, you need to talk to some general authority about that." And he said, "Which one?" And he didn't know which one. I mean, there is no explanation for why there are pentacles on the temples. There's only speculation. Nobody knows why back then they put them there. However, the church doesn't address them because they don't want to have to. I mean, it only calls attention to them. It only calls, and so you don't say, don't do New Age stuff, don't do, you know, they don't want to talk too much about that because there's just too much, the church has such a rich tradition of divination. I mean, read John Brooke, read, you know, Refiner's Fire, read Michael Quinn, and they're actually online at FAIR and even BYU professors, you know, there's some articles out there that talk about these congruences and try to explain them, but for the most part I don't think they want to draw the connection. You know, they don't want to tell you not to do much because then they draw the connection, you know, they draw attention to the connections. So I don't know that I haven't thought that far, but that's a really good question. I mean, where could all of this go?
Our time is up, and so probably the tape has cut off. But let me ask my question now. I'll tell you what has always concerned me about developing the idea of Mother in Heaven within Mormonism. I guess part of it is that if we talk about Mother in Heaven, maybe she is just one member of God's harem. And part of it is also that if the church, the institutional church, were to begin to define Mother in Heaven, rather than have this groundswell from the grassroots where people are empowered by Mother in Heaven, I'm afraid that she's going to be defined as the docile, silent, behind-the-scenes patriarchal woman that is idealized for Mormon women here, and that she's just going to be one more way that Mother in Heaven, that the patriarchy tells women to be subordinate to men. And I wonder if you've given any thought to this.
You're absolutely right. Yes? Sure. Let me just say why she's running up here. You're absolutely right. And it is, it's like this contradiction and this tension between, they've done us a favor, you know, to some extent, but they've made us be private about it, and so we don't connect with each other.
This is one of the reasons why you should all go read The Spiral Staircase by Karen Armstrong, which I keep talking about. But one of the things I read to introduce one of my panels was a discussion she has with a Jewish scholar where he makes the point that Christianity is unique in that it stresses theology. As she says, belief is the sine qua non, the point without which you cannot be religious. And in so many other religious traditions, what you believe really doesn't matter. It's what you do. Orthodoxy, who cares? It's orthopraxy. The problem is we let them tell us what to think. If we just said, to hell with you, I'm going to believe what I want. They could say whatever they wanted about Joseph Smith, Father in Heaven, Mother in Heaven, garments, whatever. Decide for yourself, goddammit.
I don't know how quite how to talk about this, but when I hear, I want to go back to the idea of magic in the Mormon Church. And I think that when we talk about paganism and Mormonism, we somewhat, it's very limiting of who we really are. And I have practiced this kind of work for many years. I put my hands on people and they find a way to heal themselves. I talk to trees and they talk back to me. Shoot, I think I'm in trouble now. I'm outing myself. But I remember when I moved back here from the Bay Area and I went to a BYU game and I walked into the stadium because I'm very sensitive to energies. And I had to literally lean against the walls of the stadium because the power and the spirit in there was so great. I said, I don't understand how, if people understand the power and the spirit that they contain within themselves. And it reminded me a lot of the movie Willow. I don't know if any of you saw it. Okay. You know, he's a little man who tries to work great magic with a little wand. And as the story progresses, he realizes he is the wand. And I look at that movie and I think we as members of the church or not members of the church are like, we have these wands and we're just picking our noses with them. And I just feel like it's time that we stepped up to the plate and we become all that we can be and stop limiting ourselves and labeling ourselves in a lot of ways.
Thank you. Probably other people are going to start coming in for the next session now. But thank you very much for this very interesting session. And thank you, audience, for your comments.